Today's episode is sponsored in part by Modern Mammals, creators of a new hair washing product for men. You can help support Based on a True Story when you use the code BOATSPODCAST at modernmammals.com for 10% off. I've really been enjoying their shampoo light bar as an alternative to traditional shampoo. And I know it's in the name, but honestly, when I first used it, I was surprised at just how light and airy it feels. It reminds me of using a bar of soap for your hair, except it's even better than that because if you're like me, you don't like the residue that some actual bars of soap leave behind. And the shampoo light bar is easy to wash out without leaving any residue behind. Modern Mammals also focuses on creating products that help you keep your hair's natural oils so it's not left feeling poofy and frizzy. Go to modernmammals.com and use code BOATSPODCAST for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code BOATSPODCAST. Don't forget to use the promo code BOATSPODCAST so they know I sent you. Thanks, Modern Mammals. Okay, let's start today's episode. Hello, and welcome to Based on a True Story, the podcast that compares your favorite Hollywood movies with history. Today, we're going to learn about the 2016 movie called A United Kingdom. Directed by Amma Asante, A United Kingdom tells the story of a controversial marriage between King Seretse Khama of Bechuanaland and a British white woman named Ruth Williams. The interracial marriage in the late 1940s sets off diplomatic chaos because Bechuanaland is both a protectorate of Britain and located near apartheid-era South Africa. To help us separate fact from fiction in the movie, we'll be joined by Jens Heike, who is the author of a brand new book called Out of the Melting Pot, Into the Fire, Multiculturalism in the World's Past and America's Future, which, of course, you can find a link to in the show notes for this episode. Before we chat with Jens, though, it's time to set up our game, Two Truths and a Lie. If you're new to the show, here's how it works. I'll give you three things. Two of them are true, and that means one of them is an all-out lie. Are you ready? Okay, here they are. Number one, Rufus Lancaster was the reason why Seretse was not allowed home. Number two, diamonds were not a deciding factor in Britain's allowing Seretse to return home. Number three, Bechuanaland was Britain's protectorate before the Union of South Africa formed. Got them? Okay, now as you're listening to our story today, your challenge is to identify which one is the lie. And of course, we'll do a recap at the end of the episode to see how well you did. All right, now it's time to connect with Jens Heike about the historical accuracy of A United Kingdom. Before we get into some of the details of the movie, if you were to give A United Kingdom a letter grade for historical accuracy, what would it get?
It would get a B plus. You know, on the whole, it's very accurate. There are some kind of annoying anachronisms in it, and a number of details they got wrong. But I defer to the family itself. So the Khama family, when it came out, they were actually very pleased with the movie. The only real criticism they had, they said, you know, Seretse was much more serious in real life. He wasn't nearly that emotional. He was a much more stoic character. Which is kind of curious because he seemed pretty stoic in the movie, actually.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I guess the movie it does focus a lot more on the romantic side, kind of that aspect of it, and the stoic royalty side of it definitely plays a part, but maybe perhaps they played up the drama side a little bit more for the movie, which again is normal. It's a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And there were a couple of bits, little things that jumped out at me. For example, Seretse and Ruth, when Ruth was down in Botswana or Bechuanaland, and he was up in the United Kingdom, they were talking on the phone. And, you know, there was no phone cable between England and Southern Africa until 1968, you know, 18 years after that was supposed to take place. But, you know, it was mostly smaller details like that. On the whole, they really, you know, pretty true to reality.
Well, if we go to the movie and the way the movie starts in 1947 with Sarete Khama, and he's about to return to his homeland of Bechuanaland, as you mentioned. He'd been studying in law in London while his uncle, Jacquetti, was the regent in Bechuanaland until Sarete was ready to rule. And now, according to the movie, that time has come. We also learn early in the movie that when Sarete's grandfather was king, he asked for Queen Victoria's protection from the racialist South Africa. So now the way the movie kind of establishes everything, it sets up the timeline of the movie in the beginning. Bechuanaland is a protectorate of Britain and Sarete is coming home. How well does the movie do setting up the situation in 1947 for Bechuanaland?
Well, it got a little bit of that wrong because appealing to make Bechuanaland a protectorate in the movie, Sarete attributed that to racialist South Africa. Well, that was an anachronism because the Union of South Africa didn't exist until 1910, and Bechuanaland got protectorate status in 1885, so long time before South Africa per se existed. What did happen is there were Boer trekkers, Afrikaners, who were coming up from the Natal province and basically infiltrating Bechuanaland and taking over land. So that was really the initial start to apply for protectorate status. But what really motivated that visit by Khama III, who was Sarete's grandfather, what motivated that visit was that Cecil Rhodes wanted to annex Bechuanaland, and they had to make a case against doing that. So Khama III, along with several other tribal leaders, took a long trip to England. They spent several months there, visited Queen Victoria and persuaded her and the British government to enhance that protectorate status and stop Cecil Rhodes. So, you know, the short answer is it wasn't South African racialism. Actually, it was Rhodesian racialism that filling that to happen.
So then would that be why, I think there was a mention in the movie that Sarete was studying law there in London. Would that be why he was studying law as a way of trying to help his country in that?
Exactly. So his uncle determined, he literally said, if we're going to protect ourselves against the white man, we need to know his laws. And Sarete was an assiduous student, clearly a very, very sharp guy and did quite well at it.
As I'm recording this right now, on the other side of my door is my cat. He's always wherever I am as I'm working on the podcast. He watches all the movies with me, and he lets me know when it's time to stop working by sitting on my keyboard. I love the little guy. And as a pet owner, that means there are expenses like vet bills that can pop up, and sometimes that's unexpected. That's why I was happy to learn about today's sponsor, EarnIn, because they can help make sure that I've got the money to cover those unexpected vet bills. EarnIn is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. Now you can join over 3.5 million customers, get the peace of mind that comes with EarnIn. Download EarnIn today, spelled EARNIN, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the EarnIn app, type in True Story under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. True Story under podcast. EarnIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. Thanks, EarnIn. If we go back into the movie's timeline, before Sarete returns to Bechuanaland, he does meet Ruth Williams. It's at a missionary society dance that we see there. They catch each other's attention right away, kind of seeing each other from across the room. And then the movie doesn't really explain how much time is passing, but we see a montage of dancing, chatting, playing pool, spending time with each other. This romance is obviously growing. And then we see there's a scene where Sarete tells Ruth that it's time, he has to go back home, but he can't leave his heart in London. So he gets down on one knee and proposes to her, and she says yes. How well does the movie do showing how Sarete and Ruth met and fell in love?
You know, I felt like I did a pretty good job there. The timeline felt a little compressed. Their courtship, from the time they met to the time they married, lasted a full year. The actual proposal, they got a little off. They showed it occurring on the south bank of the Thames River. It in fact occurred at his residence hall, which is over by Marble Arch. It's a place I've actually walked by several times, and I can tell you it's not as romantic or glamorous.
It doesn't make for a good movie scene, apparently.
So, you know, on the whole, it was accurate. You know, the part I wish they had shown, which would have been fun, is Cerezzi was a tremendous athlete. And they conveyed that. He played rugby at Oxford. He was, you know, a boxer. He was, however, a terrible ice skater, and whereas Ruth was quite a good one, and that they had a couple of dates where they did ice skating, and after that, they did between more.
Way that could have added some humor into the movie, showing that contrast there. Well, according to the movie, there were a lot of different reactions from people about this upcoming marriage between Cerezzi and Ruth, and at least in the movie, none of them really seem to be very approving of it. Ruth's father practically disowns her for marrying a black man, while Cerezzi's uncle refuses to allow him to become king in Bechuanaland as long as he's married to a white woman. And then there's Sir Alistair Canning, who's the British government's representative in South Africa, according to the movie. And he immediately tells them, being the couple, Cerezzi and Ruth, that the neighboring countries in Africa have demanded that the marriage not take place. Despite this, according to the movie, the two end up getting married in what looks like a pretty small ceremony, maybe a dozen people there or so, not a lot of people in the ceremony in the movie. Was the movie correct to show kind of these initial reactions to the marriage between Cerezzi and Ruth?
Yeah, it was dead on. In fact, there were a few things they didn't show. It is absolutely correct that Ruth's father said that if they got married, she would no longer be welcome in their house. And he followed through with that. He actually did that. What they didn't show is that her boss at Lloyd's, who was actually a good friend of hers, was so opposed to the marriage that he basically fired her. He told her she could transfer to New York and lose her job, which was equivalent to firing her at the time. So on the whole, that portrayal was absolutely dead on. The British, I should qualify one thing, that this Alistair Canning character, by the way, didn't exist.
Okay.
Of course, no such character. The closest corresponding real-life person was a figure by the name of Evelyn Baring. If you think of Baring's Bank, same family. So he was very aristocratic, and he was actually based in South Africa. He was a high commissioner from South Africa, and he was very much opposed. The overall British public they found the whole thing really pretty controversial and outrageous. Papers made a big deal of it at the time. Black people, you have to remember, in England, I could say that at that point in time, they constituted less than you know, 400 or 500ths of a percent of the population. So very, very few black people in the country. And the country, I would guess, on the whole, was very much opposed to interracial marriage. We don't have polls for the UK, but I know that in the United States, 1958, 94% of the American public was opposed to interracial marriage. To give you an idea of what a novelty it was in England at the time, while this controversy was raging, and this was the most controversial marriage of this century, really, even beyond the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. One of the papers actually ran an article by a biologist discussing whether or not it was possible for a mixed race couple to have children. If you can imagine that. So apparently the British public, this was such an unusual occurrence, they had to be educated on it.
They had to have known that there was going to be some controversy around it, just being in that time period. Were they kind of blindsided by just how controversial it was and all these things that came out about their marriage?
They definitely understood it wouldn't be a problem. Ruth knew from the beginning the father would have a problem, and she actually sort of hid the relationship from him. Her mother figured it out. In fact, her mother had lunch with her and Cerezzi prior to her telling her father. And so they knew up front that that would be a problem. They were caught off guard by the opposition of the London Missionary Society and how involved the British government got. So you mentioned they had a small ceremony. What they didn't show in the movie is that the couple was actually going to have a wedding in a local church, in an Anglican church. But the Missionary Society basically plotted against that. They positioned these goons at the back of the church to protest when that moment in the ceremony came up. As it turned out, they actually persuaded the vicar not to perform the ceremony. And beyond that, but then they persuaded the Bishop of London not to allow any of his people to officiate, which is why they ended up getting married in a civil procedure instead.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. They show some controversy, of course, but it sounds like it was even more than what we see in the movie.
Absolutely. On the African part, Tsikiti, who was really a pretty good character in the end, he was so opposed to interracial relationships that when he was acting as regent a few years earlier, he had a white man flogged because that man was consorting with black women in his tribal area. And that became a huge controversy. In fact, the British government briefly removed him from his position because he had done that. But, oh, so wow. he was the instigator of a lot of the opposition to America early on.
You mentioned the British government and their opposition there, and that leads right into my next question that I had about it. Because in the movie, after they're married, we see Cerezzi and Ruth get married. They travel back to Bechuanaland. And when they get there, again, now we know the fictional character of Alistair Canning. And then there's another man that enters the picture here, Rufus Lancaster. He's the district commander, according to the movie. He says that it is Cerezzi's uncle that's refusing to accept Ruth as queen. And there's a line of dialogue in there that sounds basically like it's a threat that if he doesn't, or like when Rufus says that if Cerezzi doesn't give up his claim to chieftainship and is forcing his tribe to take sides between himself, Cerezzi, and his uncle, then that's going to make the country ungovernable. And then Britain might not be able to prevent South Africa from annexing Bechuanaland, which is, as I was listening to that, seeing that in the movie, I was like, oh, well, this is a threat without come out and saying it's a threat. Like, oh, if you're going to force the country to take sides, then we might not protect you anymore. And as a protectorate, well, you're not going to get our protection there. Was there really that sort of imposition and pressure from the British government on the marriage?
Yeah, there absolutely, there was that pressure, but they got the timeline a little bit mixed up. So what really happened is Cerezzi went back to the Bechuanaland by himself. He didn't bring Ruth with him at the time because he thought it would be too inflammatory. So he went by himself, participated in that cult well, which they showed, and to persuade the tribe that it was okay for them to accept his wife and for them to accept the mixed race couple was to rule the country. So that happened first. And the British officials initially didn't have a problem with that. They kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, oh, the Hotla said it was okay. It's okay. And then they started to think about the implications of relations with South Africa. And then they started to get worried. As it turns out, that character Rufus Lancaster also didn't exist. The guy on the ground there was a guy by the name of Sillery. And he was actually pretty sympathetic to Ruth and Cerezzi. He wasn't the character they showed in the movie at all.
When we do see the newlyweds arrive in Bechuanaland, right away we see some racial segregation. There's a whites-only sign at the hotel as soon as they arrive there. And we also see, again, fiction. I'm assuming Alistair Canning's wife then in the movie, Lily, is also fictional since he was fictional. But she asks Ruth if she wants something to drink, and Ruth says something like, I love a gin and lime. And then she goes to Cerezzi and says, well, I'll give you lemonade because, you know, there's a prohibition of alcohol for blacks in Bechuanaland. Can you fill in some more of the historical context around the racial segregation?
Yeah. So, you know, that was a very accurate portrayal. There was what they call a color bar there and also in other British protectorates. In fact, the book that this movie was based on is called The Color Bar. So it was the case that the blacks were banned altogether from some of the white establishments. Other ones, they were allowed, but they could only enter through the back door, or they could get things, but they had to take them out. They had to either consume them outside or go elsewhere. So that part was very accurate. The bit about the alcohol needs some qualification. That was not imposed by the British government or the white establishments. That came from Kama the Third, Tsaretsi's grandfather, who was absolutely opposed to alcohol. And Tsaretsi's uncle, Tsukedi, followed up on that. He maintained that ban on alcohol because he thought it was a bad thing for the local people. So that was the one part they missed. And that actually didn't come from the British. That came from the tribal administration itself.
Okay. What about, there was a, when we see that, I think Tsaretsi, I don't remember the exact line of dialogue, but he mentioned something about how, well, as the king, he has some exceptions. So he could go into the whites only area in the hotel there. Was there some exception there for him?
Yeah. So that was exactly correct. They didn't really explain the reasons for it. Tsaketi as regent and Tsaretsi as king had the power to remove those traders and the owners of those establishments from the Vanuatu territory. So those people have to be pretty deferential to Tsaketi and Tsaretsi because they held power over them. They could, and I think in one or two cases they did kick people out. So they wanted, they wanted to keep their stores there. So they have to be nice.
Okay. Well, that puts another perspective on something else that we see in the movie too, with when Ruth first arrives, there's a scene where she goes into a shop. She goes shopping for the first time. The store owner, I'm assuming the store owner, the lady behind the desk, she's a white woman, and she does not take kindly to Ruth being there. It's not until Tsaretsi's sister, Naledi, comes in and kind of tides things over between them. But it sounds, that puts a different perspective on it, because I would think, well, if the store owner knows that, okay, this is Tsaretsi's wife and he has power, I might want to treat her a little nicer than we see happening in the movie.
It is a fact that she was treated shabbily by probably the majority of the white traders and store owners in the area, for whatever reason. I guess somehow they were that worried that she would tell her husband and that there would be repercussions for them, because they, on the whole, did treat her pretty shabbily. They really only had a handful of white friends when they first got there. And in fact, Tsaretsi made some wry comments at one point about how much more cosmopolitan and sophisticated is tribal people of South Africa or Botswana land were compared to these white people who were so unaccepting.
If we go back to the movie, after we see Tsaretsi refusing to give up his claim to the chieftainship, and then his uncle leaves and he's going off to start a new settlement somewhere else. And Tsaretsi then is told, I think it was Canning that mentioned to him that he needs to go to London so they can talk to him about the matter of his chieftainship face to face. They say it'll happen faster if we talk about this face to face. I thought it was interesting. Just as a little side note, it was Canning that mentioned that, but then when he gets to London, it's also Canning that he's talking to. why I have to go to London to talk to the same person that was down there in Botswana land?
Well, that really underscores the fact that this Canning was a composite of two different people. So he was a composite of Barry, who was located in Pretoria, based in Southern Africa, and Commonwealth Secretary, who was located up in London.
Okay, so it wasn't the same person traveling back and forth.
So it actually was two different characters. So he went up to meet the Commonwealth Secretary.
I thought there had to be something there because I was like, wait, why? I mean, you just talked to him down here, like instead of in his office in London. It didn't make much sense. When he gets there, when Sverdsky gets there, he thinks that he has Ruth stay behind because he thinks if he goes to London, then Ruth isn't, they're not going to let Ruth go back to Africa with him after she's in London. So he goes by himself. Ruth stays behind in Bechuanaland. But then when he gets there, Sretzi's kind of thrown off guard when he's told that he can't return home. They're exiling him from Bechuanaland for 5 years. Did that happen?
Yeah. So that was completely accurately portrayed, or right down to the fact that Sretzi and Ruth and the Bangawato people perceived that they were pretty sure that the British government was up to some trickery. And that is, in fact, why Ruth stayed. I think where they miscalculated is they thought that probably Sretzi would be allowed to return, and they made a mistake there. Now, the person that was the first Commonwealth secretary that they dealt with at the time was really kind of disconsolate over the fact that he had to perform this, you know, this subterfuge, this trickery. And, you know, he wrote some comments at the time that he really hated his role in it. When it did happen, Sverdsky had a press conference, which, by the way, you can actually see on YouTube. It's kind of interesting to watch, where he talked about how he had been tricked. And there was a lot of outrage in the public and in the press over this, because it just offended this sense of fair play that British people had. And a few days later, Winston Churchill, who was opposition leader, famously muttered in Parliament, he said, "Oh, this is a most disreputable affair." And, you know, he was ticked off at it, as along with a bunch of legal backbenchers, because they just felt it violated the sense of, you know, British fair play and violated the sense of honor that they have.
I love your Churchill voice there. That was great.
Thank you.
I did want to ask about Churchill, though, because he is mentioned in the movie, and there's some a point where we hear some radio reports. We don't hear Churchill himself, but we hear some radio reports saying that Churchill is talking about Sverdsky being able to go home to his wife. But then there's an election, and after the election, Churchill wins, and then he turns around and says, "Nope, Sverdsky, you're not banned for 5 years. You're banned for life." Did he really change his mind like that?
Yeah. So whether or not he changed his mind, we do know that the administration, you know, took a different policy than what Churchill was talking about prior to that. So that's absolutely correct. It changed directions. We didn't really get the backstory for that. We can actually only speculate about it. But what we do know is that there were only a handful of ministers in the Attlee government who were aware of negotiations between Britain and South Africa over uranium. Britain really wanted this uranium, and so there's all kinds of stuff going back and forth, but it was only a handful of ministers who knew about this and the strategic importance of not ticking off South Africa. So it's quite likely that Churchill and his ministers weren't aware of any of that until they actually took their role in government. And then they became aware, and principles kind of went out the window, and they said, you know, we have to follow principles, realpolitik instead, and appease South Africa.
Of course, throwing the name Churchill out there being a well-known name, but it also gave me the impression between that and kind of things we talked about up until now with just the British public and stuff, was that even after they were in Bechuanaland, it was still a big deal to the British government, and kind of a maybe even a big deal to the British public as well. You know, that they're having all these radio reports, and throughout the movie, there are times where we see, like, you know, newspaper headlines talking about Sverdsky and Ruth and, you know, the situation going on there. Did they stay in the news like that? Was it a bigger thing even after they left London and went back?
Yes, it absolutely was. Mm-hmm. And it began as a big deal. In fact, when Ruth came down to the Bechuanaland on her own, and she actually went under a secret identity. She went as Mrs. Jones because she was trying to hide from the press. And they had the mistaken notion that somehow they would escape the press when they were down there. In fact, when they got there, they were chased all over the place by, you know, these carloads full of journalists everywhere from Australia to the United States. One journalist even rented a plane to follow them around in.
Wow.
You know, it was just a circus. There was one crazy incident where they were staying at a friend's house in Moape, and these journalists with their photographers desperately wanted to get this photo of the black man and the white woman in bed together. So they were poking around the windows, and they unfortunately for them got the wrong window, and they came face to face with a shotgun held by the son of the couple that was hosting that.
Serves them right for trying to invade on privacy there. I mean, yeah. Old school paparazzi, it sounds like.
Yeah.
You touched on something there with the uranium, and we do see that mentioned in the movie. There's a report that's actually mentioned throughout the movie. The Chief Justice of the High Commission Territory is the title of Sir Walter Harrigan, according to the movie. And the Harrigan report is something that early on in the movie, the character of Canning uses as an excuse. It says that Soretse is not fit to rule, and that's why the British government exiles him, according to the movie. And then toward the beginning of the movie, and then as the movie kind of nears its end, Soretse actually manages to get his hands on a copy of the report, and he finds out that that's not what the report says at all. Harrigan actually said that Soretse is fit to rule, but he and Ruth are not acceptable to South Africa. And then it starts to bring in South Africa provides uranium, gold, some protection from Stalin's advance in Africa. All these things seem to imply that the British government is justifying Prime Minister Malan's apartheid in South Africa, even allowing it to affect Soretse and Ruth. Because I think there was a line in the movie from one of the parliament members, like, without the gold reserves from South Africa, how is the British currency going to be sustained? How well did the movie do showing this power? Was it really that much power that South Africa was holding over Britain's influence?
Yeah, it was pretty much dead on there. There were multiple things. The previous government of South Africa, the previous Prime Minister, Jan Smuts, had lent 9 million ounces of gold to Britain. And Britain just, you know, it was in shambles after World War II. It didn't have the wherewithal to pay that. And add on to that uranium, which was a huge issue for South Africa, for Great Britain, because they desperately wanted to have a nuclear program. And the United States kind of wasn't helping at that point. They weren't being very helpful. And the sort of leverage that Great Britain had, the only leverage they had, was their lock on the South African uranium. So they really desperately felt like they needed that. And then to top all of that off, there was this issue that the British government put their imprimatur on the marriage of Ruth and Soretse. It would so enrage the white South African public and the far right extremists in South Africa, that they would just move in and invade Bechuana land and annex it. And the British government really couldn't do anything about it. Again, it's right about the report. See, the ministers who commissioned the report made the mistake that they basically enlisted an honest guy to do it.
They made the mistake of enlisting, and I love that.
Yeah, sorry. You know, it's like I talked earlier about Sillery, their guy on the ground. They actually passed him over to the commission to choose someone else because Sillery was too sympathetic, and they knew that. They just didn't know that Harrigan was going to be honest, and he gave them the answer they wanted, that Soretse shouldn't be king, but he gave them the honest reasons for it, which they really didn't want. These were reasons they wanted to hide. And well, why did they want to hide them? Well, they didn't want to admit that South Africa has a movement barrel, and they didn't want to admit that they was appeasing this racist government. It would have been terrible publicity. So they had to hide the whole thing.
Was South Africa aware of their whole, how much hold they had over Britain? Or was that, I mean, that I'm assuming from your answer there, that was part of the reason why Britain wanted to hide it, was they didn't want South Africa to know just how much power they had.
Yeah, I think they were aware to a degree. I think they probably didn't know quite what hold they had. And it is interesting that that when Cerezi was banned, the British officials were carefully monitoring the South African newspapers. And the moderate newspapers down in the Cape were sort of relieved and you know, were happy that had been done. However, up in the Transvaal, where the real extremist sorts, people like not Milan, but some of the radicals in his party, they were kind of annoyed. They sounded annoyed, and the reason they were annoyed is because their pretext for invading the Shwanaland had gone away.
You said that there weren't that many people that knew about the uranium. Was it almost this? Was there elements of the British government that was almost trying to keep it from other elements of the British government too? Because there were some mentions of kind of that as well in the movie that the impression that I got walking out when we see some of the scenes in Parliament, you know, talking about the Labour Party and the Tories and all that.
Yeah, there absolutely was. And there was a lot of negotiating behind the scenes there. And in fact, the Labour government persuaded the Conservatives not to protest too much about the banning of Cerezi. So that's one thing that happened behind the scenes. Problem for the Labour leaders is they were focused on kind of squelching Conservative dissent. What happened is they really got dissent from their own backbenchers, people like Tony Benn and Fenton Rockway, who are nicely depicted in the movie. Tony Benn was a huge supporter of the commas. In fact, they named one of their sons out.
Wow.
And Fenton Rockway also helped them hugely.
You touched on a little bit ago, Britain after World War II being in shambles there. And there is a very brief mention when we see Ruth giving an address to Churchill. She mentioned something, I don't remember the numbers. Is it like 10,000? She mentions a number of, I'm assuming the movie implies soldiers from Bechuanaland that helped in World War II. Were there actually soldiers that had helped? And then this is kind of my assumption coming out of the movie is that with this a newsreel that we see Ruth film in the movie, feeling just betrayed by Churchill, like, oh, we helped you, and now you're not helping us.
Yeah, that absolutely was the case, and a lot of people from protectorates in Southern Africa did help in World War II because of the whole racist thing. They were mostly relegated to things like digging trenches and kind of doing support work. They mostly weren't, frontline type soldiers, but they contributed valiantly. So that was the source of a lot of dissatisfaction. They felt like they had been double-crossed.
As the movie comes to an end, Cerezi shows the evidence of Britain using Bechuanaland for its own purposes to his uncle, that Harrigan report that we talked about. And then his uncle, Chikadze, agrees to let their argument end. And Cerezi then uses his influence to get Parliament to agree that his people will have mineral rights to anything in Bechuanaland. He did that because he knew about some drilling and reports of finding a few diamonds. Then he uses that information mixed with the twisting of the Harrigan report to pressure the British government into allowing them to transition from a monarchy, the monarchy of Bechuanaland, into the Republic of Botswana. Was that really how that transition happened from Bechuanaland into Botswana?
So a lot of facts were mixed up here. They got a few things right. Fenton Rockway, who's a friend of the Thomas, a member of Parliament, did get the government to concede that any minerals in the country would belong to the people. So that part was accurate. The discovery of diamonds, however, really didn't happen until after Botswana got independence. And nobody was really aware of the mineral wealth at the time, and that was reflected in reports by British officials all the way up into the 1960s, where they talked about how they were happy to get rid of Botswana because it was a, you know, worthless dust bowl that was draining their cash. But what really motivated the British government to grant the country independence, or, well, first of all, to let allow Seretse back, was lots of peaceful protest and in Botswana land itself and passive resistance. The movie accurately showed a fatwa where nobody showed up, and that happened multiple times, and that went on for 5 years. Wow. And likewise, all around the British Commonwealth, and, you know, it was an international outrage for a lot of the Commonwealth countries, and in England itself, there was an organization that was devoted to getting Seretse Khama back to the country, and that included all kinds of luminaries, people like Bertrand Russell, obviously Tony Benn, Fenimore Brockway, but a lot of other prominent figures. And it was finally when people, the Bamangwato people, sent a cable to Queen Elizabeth saying, "Great Queen, please, we're sad, please send us back our rightful king." And it was at that point that the British government relented and sent back. So the Harrigan report and that stuff really wasn't involved.
Was Seretse, we do see in the movie, we see Seretse doing some radio broadcasts and kind of petitioning himself, like, you know, to the British public. Did he actually do that and start to sway? Because earlier in the movie, or earlier in our discussion, rather, we were talking about how the British public was outraged at first. Was he able to sway them into kind of helping get him back home?
Absolutely. And the people around him played a huge role, but he was a very charismatic and powerful speaker and really convincing of people. An interesting side note is that all these British officials, when you read their notes and their correspondences, and many of them were outright racist, but almost to a one, they had this sort of grudging respect of Seretse, even, you know, as they were screwing him over. You could tell they almost perceived that he was far more of a gentleman than any of them. Well, he basically out-Britished them and outclassed them. And you could, you know, his tone, he was always very calm and just argued with logic and was really had such poise that he really impressed these officials, even though they treated him shallowly.
I definitely got that from the movie, even in the performance. He seemed to always be in control of himself. Like, even when there were things that were, when it came to light that the British government was screwing them over or doing various things, when there was the marriage and that tear with his uncle had to have just torn him apart inside too. I mean, I didn't mention this earlier, but at the beginning of the movie, he talks about how his uncle raised him. He tells Ruth this, you know, his uncle raised him. He's basically a father to him. So it had to have been so much more difficult than even is voiced in the movie or just to have that sort of friction with his uncle.
Yeah. And he handled it with such incredible poise and grace. And, you know, the amazing thing to think is that, you know, he's 27 at this point. And in several instances here, it's just him. And in one case, it was a worthless lawyer who never said a thing. But with an array of like four or five senior cabinet ministers on the other side, and here's this 27-year-old guy just holding his own. It's just, he was tremendously remarkable person.
What's something from the true story that didn't make its way into the movie that you wish had been included?
So there's this one little anecdote that I think so just wonderfully illustrates the tenacity and the grit and the sheer love for her husband that Ruth had that they did in fact leave out. So there was this time when Ruth was in Shirowe by herself. She was pregnant. And what the movie doesn't show is that Seretse was actually allowed to come back to Botswana land. He just wasn't allowed to go to where she was. He had to settle this lawsuit with his uncle. So he was confined to Lhotse, which is way down in the south of the country. It's 400 miles from Tsrui. Now, Ruth determined that she wanted to get them back together no matter what. So what she did, she deprived herself of sleep for 3 whole days. She set an alarm clock, had it go off every single hour for 3 days straight. So at the end of 3 days, and I remember she's pregnant, right? So at the end of 3 days, she is a basket case. She goes to her doctor who takes your blood pressure and everything and says, oh my goodness, this young woman is in dire straits. He tells the British government and they're in a panic because if she loses a pregnancy, this is international scandal, terrible publicity. So they actually relent and they say, okay, Tsarevsky can come up and be with her for a couple of weeks. And this woman just had true grit. And Tsarevsky was an amazing man. She was also an amazing woman. Just really a remarkable character.
Knowing that Tsarevsky was allowed, but just wasn't allowed to see her, that had to have been that much more painful. Like, I mean, you're close, but not actually being able to see each other.
Exactly. And, you know, as it turns out, at the same time that she came up with this trick, he was actually conspiring himself to drive in the middle of the night of where she was and drive back, you know, 400 miles on a dirt road. So these two were, you know, they were truly in love. And again, you know, people with just tremendous character and grit.
At the very end of the movie, there is some text that mentions that Botswana became the world's biggest diamond producer, and that just transformed the economy. Tsarevsky was then democratically elected as the country's first president, according to the movie, and then Ruth became a prominent humanitarian. Did Tsarevsky and Ruth's story end as happily ever after as the movie seems to imply?
Let me begin, because I always take a little bit of umbrage at the connection of Botswana's success with the diamonds. They absolutely did contribute, but you know, when we look around Africa and frankly the rest of the world, there are so many countries. What was Zaire at the time? Angola, Namibia, Nigeria has fabulous oil wealth. Venezuela, all these countries that have wealth equal to what Botswana had. And none of them have been able to parlay it into success. And as we can talk about, I think there was something special about Botswana that allowed it to turn that mineral wealth into successful society. But to get to your other question about the living happily ever after, yes, they did to some degree. Sadly, Tsarevsky got cancer. He died before he was 60. He was president from 1966 to 1980 when he died. Ruth lived until 2002, and to this day is still regarded as a sort of a mother of the country. She devoted herself to all kinds of charitable causes, and is still very highly regarded there.
I want to ask you, because you did mention some of the difference with Botswana and your new book right here. Called Out of the Melting Pot into the Fire, Multiculturalism in the World's Past and America's Future. And the story of Bechuanaland, Botswana, is really just one example that you give. What do you think separates Botswana's story from some of the other civilizations that you cover in your book?
Yeah, so there is an element in Botswana's society that goes back at least 200 years. It's quite interesting that they've long been very accepting of outsiders and refugees and kind of bringing people into their fold and in a way that, you know, I think is pretty unusual. So if we go all the way back to the beginning of the 19th century, we've got Shaka Zulu, who's rampaging across southern Africa. He was like the, you know, sort of the Genghis Khan of southern Africa, and people are fleeing from him. And a lot of the people who were fleeing to them from him came to the Botswana people, and they were brought in and allowed to become part of that society. They were welcome. And 100 years later, the same thing happens. The Germans in Southwest Africa are persecuting a group of people called the Herero. It was first genocide of the 20th century. And the Herero who did survive fled to Cerezzi's grandfather, Conrad III. And once again, he welcomed them in. And the city that's often shown in the movie, Molape, has a significant population that's descended from those Herero people. And they're an integral part of the society and they're very successful. And that continued on until the current day. And the fact that they allowed roots in so pretty readily to allow a white woman to become part of their society. That was carrying on a tradition that goes back at least 200 years. So that was already in the culture, in the society. It was sort of in their society's DNA. But beyond that, there was a political decision on part of Cerezzi and part of the Bamangwato people that I think is nicely captured in that one wonderful speech he gives in the Hoba, where he said, you know, we look at South Africa and look at the racism among the British and how they divide people and treat them differently because of what race they are, or what group they're born into. And he says, we're not going to do any of that. We're going to go the other way. And that one speech, we don't know for sure those were the exact words he said, but that feeling was captured in the founding of the country and in the country's constitution. That we're going to be one unified society. It doesn't matter what the color is. You know, it doesn't matter what tribe you are. We're going to function as a unified community. And it's actually symbolized in the Botswana flag. It's got black and white stripes on it, which symbolize black and white people together. Their national animal, is the zebra, animal that has no tribal associations, but again, the stripes sort of symbolize black and white together. So to me, that's one of the reasons that country has been so wildly successful. I mean, on independence, it was the eighth poorest country in the world. Now it's an upper income country. And any statistic you want to look at, corruption, public health, in many of these measures, it surpasses countries in Europe, particularly in corruption. It's the least corrupt country in Africa, and it's ahead of Greece, Spain, Italy, a number of other European countries.
You talk about a lot of that in your book. So first, thank you very much for coming on to talk about a United Kingdom. But for the listeners who want to get an overview of your book, can you share a little bit about it and where they can get a copy?
Absolutely. So I'll answer the second question first. They can get a copy at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of the online sellers, as well as you can order it from bookshop.org, which will get it through your local bookstore and order it. To give a brief kind of overview of book, what it does is it addresses what I think is the most pivotal question facing our current generation. And that is, as we've had this massive influx of immigration over the last couple of decades, how are we going to bring those people into our country? And to give you an idea of the scope of that, you know, that there are 85 million people today living in immigrant households. I'm not saying that's a good or a bad thing. It's a reality, and we have to think about what's the best way to make them part of American society. Now, traditionally, we've had this sort of melting pot paradigm where everybody comes and it kind of shares, and we forge a unifying shared identity. And the alternative, which has been pushed more and more in the last couple of decades, is more of a multiculturalism, salad bowl type of paradigm, where we maintain group distinctions and treat people differently based on what group they're born into. And what my book does is it says, you know, this isn't a new dilemma. This is not a new question. This is something that society faced throughout history. So, you know, let's go back. Let's look at some of those examples. Let's see how dividing people by group worked out in Yugoslavia, for example. Or how distinguishing Hutus and Tutsis and the Rwandan, you know, identity cards, which is what the Belgian colonialists did, you know. How do things like that work out versus, you know, how does it work out when we're trying to unite people under more of a shared identity?
Learning from history. I mean, so we try not to repeat the same mistakes again.
Absolutely.
Thank you again so much for your time.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
This episode of Based on a True Story was produced by me, Dan Lefebvre. I'd like to thank Jens Heike once again for sharing his knowledge about the true story behind A United Kingdom. If you want to learn more about the true story, that's just one of the stories that Jens tells in his new book called Out of the Melting Pot, Into the Fire. As always, you can find a link to that in the show notes for this episode, as well as on the show's home on the web, Based on a True Story podcast.com. Okay, now it's time for the answer to our two truths and a lie game from the beginning of the episode. And as a quick refresher, here are the two truths and one lie. Number one, Rufus Lancaster was the reason why Seretse was not allowed home. Number two, diamonds were not a deciding factor in Britain's allowing Seretse to return home. Number three, Bechuanaland was Britain's protectorate before the Union of South Africa formed. Did you catch which one is a lie? We'll count it down this time. Let's start with number three. Bechuanaland was Britain's protectorate before the Union of South Africa formed. That is true. Even though the movie makes it seem like racialist South Africa was a driving force for Bechuanaland to petition for protectorate status from Britain, as Jens pointed out, the Union of South Africa was formed in 1910, while Bechuanaland became a protectorate of Britain in 1885. That brings us to number two. Diamonds were not a deciding factor in Britain's allowing Seretse to return home. That is also true. To clarify by being true, what I mean is that the movie was wrong to imply that diamonds and mineral rights were a key reason why Britain was pressured to allow Seretse's return to Bechuanaland. Jens explained that diamonds weren't discovered until after Botswana gained independence. So the timeline of the movie was changed there. That means number one is the lie. Rufus Lancaster was the reason why Seretse was not allowed home. As we learned, the character of Rufus Lancaster, who is played by Tom Felton in the movie, was not a real character. So, of course, it couldn't be true that he was the reason for Seretse not being able to return home. If you want to chat about this movie, hop into the Based on a True Story Discord community and start a thread. You can find it at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/discord. Last but not least, if you get value out of Based on a True Story, you can give back whatever you feel it's worth. Or you can learn how to get ad-free versions over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Once again, that's basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Until next time, thanks so much for listening, and I'll chat with you again really soon.